Many of the films mentioned in John's review, and included in the new Werner Herzog box set, star the same actor, Klaus Kinski, who died in 1991. Kinski usually portrayed larger-than-life characters driven by obsessions or plagued by demons. He was the warrior in Aguirre the Wrath of God, the visionary in Fitzcarraldo, the vampire in Nosferatu, and the murderer in Wojciech. My Best Fiend, Herzog's documentary about the actor, examined their very volatile yet productive collaboration. It's one of the films included in the new box set. When Terry spoke with Werner Herzog in 1998, she asked him whether Klaus Kinski had a touch of madness in him, and if that made him especially good at playing madmen.
Yes, certainly, that there was a high amount of hysteria inside this man. There was a blurred borderline between sanity and paranoia. I mean, the man was totally over the cliff sometimes. He was the most difficult one in the world. I think that a man like Marlon Brando was only kindergarten against him. So Kinski would, Kinski was the ultimate pestilence, and all the other actors in the crew would say, "Oh my God, how can you do this again to me, to us, to engage him again?" And I said, forget about all the hardships with him. He's somehow blessed. He has some touch of genius. There is something which makes it all worthwhile to go through it.
Let me ask you about your film, Aguirre, the Wrath of God, from the early 70s, which Klaus Kinski starred in as the head of a Spanish expedition to Peru. And he becomes a madman, and he keeps pushing his men forward in this expedition, forward into crossing mountains and fording rivers that they can't possibly survive. And he just becomes more and more obsessed and mad as the expedition becomes more and more dangerous and more people die. What did you tell Kinski about the character?
I do believe that Kinski understood the character instantly once he read the screenplay.
I should say this is set in like 1560. I don't think I mentioned that.
Yes, it's yeah. Spanish conquistadors yeah. in search of El Dorado, and an entire army disappears without a trace in the jungle. So that's basically the story. And a madman, Kinski, grasps power and grabs power and leads everyone into inevitable death.
So you were saying what you told him about the role.
He read the screenplay, and 3 days later, I had a call at 3 a.m. It lasted until 4, and I could not understand who was on the line because there were these inarticulate screams for half an hour, and I had the feeling I should stay on the phone, and I realized it was Kinski. And he kept screaming, then it became a little bit more articulate that this was the figure he always wanted to play. This was the role for him. And I had the feeling the man had understood exactly what it was all about.
The last line he speaks in the film, after he's gone completely mad and everybody is basically dead, he says, "We will endure. I am Aguirre, the wrath of God. Who else is with me?"
Well, you have to know the situation. He's on a raft with dying and dead Spaniards floating down into some void of the Amazon basin, and hundreds of little monkeys have invaded the raft. And they swarm all around him, and he grabs a monkey and he talks to the monkey, and he, mad as he is, he is planning to found the purest dynasty on earth with his own daughter, who is actually dying. And he talks to a monkey and he says, "I'm the wrath, I'm Aguirre, I'm the wrath of God. Who else is with me?" And then tosses the monkey away.
There's a wonderful camera shot. You know, you described this last scene here in which Kinski's, you know, saying, "I am Aguirre, the wrath of God." And everyone, the raft that he's on is just in complete shambles. And all the remaining people are either dying or they're already dead, and as you said, you know, the monkeys have invaded the raft and they're all over. And the camera first kind of like zooms across the river to the raft and then circles around the raft in this slow but still kind of dizzying shot. Would you talk to me about that shot? It's really a magnificent shot. It's the shot that closes the movie.
Yeah, it's the most simple thing you can do. Everybody thought it was a very complicated type of helicopter shot. It was actually a regular speedboat, and I maneuvered it myself because I have a very good sense in my body how fast the camera should approach and then circle around the raft. The only problem is that when you slow your boat down, coming from such a speed, you create a huge wake which overtakes you. And you have to look behind you and see what is happening. And so I kept looking at the camera and I kept looking at the wake behind me, and I hardly could see the raft. I almost collided a couple of times with it, and I kept circling around it until we actually collided. But by then the film in the camera had run out.
There's such intensity on Kinski's face in the film. And I'm wondering how he prepared for the role, what advice you gave him for that role, and how he prepared for it to capture the madness, the obsession.
There is no rule for that. I'm not into this kind of method acting like Lee Strasberg's studio. I just loathe these kind of endless talks about a character. It went in a different way. Sometimes, for example, when Aguirre turns mad and he declares to his men that he was the wrath of God, and he threatens them and says, everyone who or whoever just takes one grain of corn too much will be imprisoned for 155 years. And he says, if I, a girl, want the birds to drop dead from the trees, the birds will drop dead from the trees. So we had the text. Kinski wanted to play it, to scream and throw a tantrum and have a fit of insanity. And I had the feeling it would be much, much better to have it at very low level, totally reduced, totally dangerous, almost in whispers. So I provoked Kinski with a very nasty remark, and Kinski started to scream and throw a tantrum. So he kept screaming for 1.5 hours until there was froth at his mouth. And then he had exhausted himself. He was kind of finished and destroyed. And then I said, roll the camera. And I said, Klaus, this is wonderful now. Let's try it and keep it very, very low in voice. Do it. And he did it, and he did it once, and that was it. And it's one of the greatest scenes I've ever seen on a screen.
Now, you made two films that I know of with Kinski in the jungle, Aguirre and Fitzcarraldo. Did you get along well in the jungle together? I mean, I imagine that making a film in the jungle, I know that making a film in the jungle is exceptionally difficult, and I know Fitzcarraldo had many, many difficulties that you had to overcome. But what did that do to your relationship with Kinski?
Of course, there were moments of great harmony, and there were moments of unbelievable confrontations, and one of the worst was for no reason whatsoever, Kinski threatened to leave the set 11 days before the end of shooting.
Which film was it?
I'm speaking of Aguirre, The Wrath of God.
Mm-hmm.
So my first film together with him, and he packed all his things into a speedboat and he was just about to leave. Of course, that would have destroyed the entire film, and I told him that I had made up my mind months ago what would be the borderline of what could be acceptable and not. And of course, the film, in my opinion, had more value than his or my private feelings and disgust or whatever. And I said to him, if you leave the set now, you will reach a bend of the next bend of the river, and I will shoot you. You will have 8 bullets through your head, and the last one is going to be for me. So the bastard somehow realized that this was not a joke anymore. It wouldn't have taken me 1 second to deliberate. And he sensed that, and he screamed for help. He screamed for the crew to help him, assist him against this madman, and he meant me. And he screamed for police, but of course the next police station was 450 miles away. result was that he was very docile during the last 11 days of shooting, and we finished the film.
You really think you would have shot him?
If I try to put myself into the situation, and that was back in 1972, beginning of 72, so 27 years ago. Yes, I think so.
Was he angry with you? Did he think you were pushing him too hard for the movie?
No, or? No. It was just somehow he had forgotten his lines, and he always would look for an excuse, and he screamed that an assistant sound man had grinned at him, and I had to dismiss him on the spot. And I said, no, number one, he didn't grin. And even if he had grinned, we just repeat that thing and we take him out of your line of eyesight. That's all right. And I cannot, and he ultimately demanded me to dismiss him right on the spot. And of course, the entire crew would have walked out of the film if I had done such an injustice. It was his fault. It was his mistake. He just did not, was unprepared and didn't know his lines anymore. In the moment he stopped, he would find some sort of an opponent or some reason why he had stumbled.
So it was basically a really large temper tantrum.
It was more than that. It was close to, very close to insanity.
Oh, okay, yeah. I want to ask you about another film that you made with Klaus Kinski, and that's Nosferatu. I love this version of the vampire story. Instead of the kind of dapper count that most Americans are familiar with through Bela Lugosi, he's a very rat-like ghoul, but one who seems very pained by his sentence of interminable life and pained by the fact that he has to drink people's blood. But it's inevitable. He must. He has to. And he does it. Would you talk a little bit about your vision of Nosferatu?
Well, my Nosferatu is based on the greatest German film ever, in my opinion at least, Murnau's silent classic Nosferatu, which Murnau did in 1924. And as a German filmmaker after the war, we grew up as, not only me, but all my peers, we grew up as a fatherless generation, as a generation of orphans. Our fathers either had fled the country, were chased out, or they had sided with the barbarism of the Nazi regime. So we had no one to learn from, and we started to look out for our grandfathers, and that was Murnau or Fritz Lang and others. So I just needed to connect myself with a culture, with a legitimate great culture of Germany, and that was the culture of the grandfathers, or even earlier than that. So I made this film, but of course it's an homage to Murnau and has been very important for me to do that film.
You were born in 1942 and grew up in Germany in the very end of the war and in the post-war period. I'm wondering what your early memories are of the war or the post-war period.
I do have clear memories of that time. You have to imagine that when I was born in Munich, only 2 weeks later, a bomb hit the house next to us, and our place was half destroyed, and my mother discovered me, the baby, under a foot of shards of glass and debris. But I was unhurt, but my mother fled to the remotest mountain valley in Bavaria, and we got stuck there. So by the age of 11, I had no idea what a telephone was. I had never seen movies. I'd never seen a TV set. I barely had seen cars in my life. And you may not believe this, but I made my first phone call at the age of 17. But I made my first movie at the age of 19. So that explains a little bit about the background. And of course, I remember the hardships, and I remember that I was hungry as a child and we had nothing to eat and things like this, which was quite all right because I had a wonderful childhood and I wouldn't like to miss that.
You are very interested as a filmmaker in unusual and sometimes surrealistic kind of landscapes. and extreme landscapes, whether it's the jungle or the desert or a bombed out area. And I'm wondering if you had a lot of visual images like that kind of imprinted in you in the post-war era when Germany was so bombed out.
No, I belong to those Germans who didn't have a childhood image of the post-war Germany, because in this mountain village there was no real warfare. It was just occupied by 60 Americans at the very, very end of the war. It was the last pocket of unoccupied territory when Germany shrank more and more and more. All of a sudden, this was the last remaining unoccupied square mile or whatever. And 60 Americans moved in jeeps, and they were totally relaxed, chewing gum. And I had the feeling this was all the Americans of the world. And for the first time, I saw a black man. And I was totally mesmerized by seeing him, because I had only heard about black people in fairy tales. And I immediately became friends with him and talked to him for hours. So what I want to say is the climate was not the climate of total destruction that Germany had witnessed all around me. It was a mountain village, a mountain valley, remote and just nature around. And only when I was 11 and the war was well over, I saw destroyed cities and bombed out places. Everybody thinks that German children who grew up in the post-war time had a terrible childhood. In the contrary, nobody was frightened. All my school friends who grew up in the cities, they are delirious about speaking of this time when they grew up in ruins, and it was pure anarchy in the best sense of the word. There were no fathers around to tell them what to do and how to do things. They would be the masters and the kings of, let's say, a whole block that was bombed out, and they would it was the most wonderful playground for children. Or for example, in my case, in this last days of war, some soldiers had fled into this area and had hidden their weapons under the hay or in the forest. And by age 4, age 5, I had a working submachine gun and fired with it. And I tried to hunt a crow because I wanted to make a soup. I was so hungry. And my mother discovered that, and she was totally calm and explained to us how lethal a weapon like that could be by just demonstrating it, by shooting one single round through a thick log of beech wood. And we were so stunned by the violence and force of such a weapon that we immediately had a clear sense how to behave. And it was just learning by experience. And the childhood of practically all the children who grew up in the post-war time was wonderful, as strange and as paradoxical as it may sound.
I was amazed at how some of the images were shaded in, and there was a certain amount of depth implied in how they were shaded. I was expecting, when I walked into your film, to see amazing line drawings and stick figures, you know, and it's so much more sophisticated than that.
Well, I think art as it bursts on the scene 32,000 years ago is fully accomplished. It doesn't start with I say it in quotes, primitive scribblings and first attempts like children would make drawings. The whole ensemble of the cave and all the paintings is awesome. So it's very hard to single out one specific part of it. But for me, the most intense of all is the so-called panel of lions. You see lions, 5, 6, 7 of them stalking something, their eyes with incredible intensity pointed, all exactly pointed at one object, and you don't know what they are stalking. So it's really very, very beautiful, very intense, very accomplished.
Now, the Chauvet Cave where you filmed wasn't discovered until 1994. Tell us some of the things that the keepers of the cave have been doing to keep it as untouched, as pristine as possible.
When they discovered the cave, they did everything right to preserve it. They immediately understood the importance of the cave. They would only very carefully move along the floor by spreading out sheets of plastic and step on it, because you could immediately see that there were fairly fresh tracks of cave bears. The cave bear actually went extinct 20,000 or so years ago, but there are still fresh tracks of them. And, of course, later, when scientists moved in, they did it with utmost caution, never touching anything. A metal walkway was built, and you never leave this walkway.
So once you decided you wanted to make this film about the Chauvet Cave, how did you get permission to go inside with a film crew and shoot it, considering how hard they've been working at the cave to keep people out of it so that the cave can be maintained?
Yes, of course, it was the biggest of all battles. I had to approach the Ministry of Culture, but there's also the regional government, which has to give its okay, and, of course, the scientists, the Council of the Scientists. And I was very lucky that the French Minister of Culture, Frédéric Mitterrand, he's a nephew of the former president, Frédéric Mitterrand turned out to be a great fan of my films. But French can be very territorial when it comes to their own patrimony, their patrimony, their legacy in art, in culture. And, of course, me as a Bavarian filmmaker, why am I going to do this and not a French one?
Well, what about the regional government and the scientists? Did they know your movies, and were they open to the idea of you doing the film?
Well, they had to be convinced, and I had to explain myself how I would do it technically. Of course, the restrictions were enormous. I was only allowed 4 hours a day for a week. I was only allowed 3 men with me. I was only allowed to carry along what we could carry in our hands, so we couldn't move heavy equipment in there and install it. Lights that would only emit light without any temperature. Of course, all the restrictions. You never step off the metal walkway. This is why the crew sometimes could not hide away. You cannot just step behind the camera and hide, because you would step on the floor of the cave. And, of course, 3D cameras are fairly clumsy. And, of course, we were not allowed to have support from outside. You see, the climate in the cave is so delicate. They open the steel door for entering, and they open it for getting us out. But if we had forgotten something, yes, we would open the door again, but that would have meant the end of the day of shooting.
And you mentioned it's this kind of crystal landscape. Everything is covered in this calcified crystal. Where does that come from?
Seeping water that actually leaves layers, creates formations of stalactites and stalagmites. What is also significant, it is so fresh. It is so as if it had been left yesterday. Things are so fresh, and all of a sudden you see a painting of a cave bear, a charcoal painting, and about half an inch layer of calcite over it, which takes thousands of years to form. So you know this is not a forgery. That was actually the first indication. This is not a forgery. This is for real. And of course, through radiocarbon dating, you can establish fairly precisely when was the painting done. There are swipe marks of torches. You see, when a torch burns down, and in order to rekindle it, it's like cutting the wick of a candle, you swipe the torch against the wall, and little fragments of charcoal were analyzed through radiocarbon dating, and we know pretty precisely when somebody swiped this torch, something, let's say, 28,400 years ago.
Now, there's a scene in your documentary about the cave in which you're talking about the possibility, with all the torches inside, that our ancestors would have been able to see their shadows and see shadows
yes,
on the wall.
Most certainly, yes.
Yes, and that leads you to think about shadow dancing, and that leads you to think about Fred Astaire in the shadow dancing scene, and then you show the Fred Astaire.
I couldn't help it.
You couldn't
I
help
could
it.
Not help it.
No, I have to stop you here. Wait. I actually met you a few years ago at a reception after you after a screening of your films at the University of Pennsylvania. And you were talking about how you had been watching Fred Astaire films. So I thought, okay, I see how Fred Astaire ended up in this documentary about a 30,000-year-old cave because you were watching Fred Astaire films. Go ahead.
Yes, that is correct. Yeah, it is for me certainly the greatest single sequence in all of film history. Fred Astaire dancing with his own shadows, and all of a sudden he stops and the shadows become independent and dance without him, and he has to catch up with them. I mean, it's just so quintessential movie. It can't get more beautiful. It's actually from Swing Time. And when you look at the cave and there are certain panels, there's evidence of some fires on the ground. They were not for cooking. They were, because there's no evidence of any habitation in there, they were used for illumination. You have to step in front of these fires to look at the images. And, of course, when you move, you must see your own shadow. And immediately Fred Astaire comes to mind, who did something 32,000 years later, which is essentially what we can imagine for early Paleolithic people.
Now, the question comes up, what's the difference between a Werner Herzog documentary about a cave and anybody else's, you know, National Geographic documentary about a cave? And I think you just answered that in a way, that your imagination is seeing all these connections. Suddenly Fred Astaire is shadow dancing in your movie. And, you know, you're talking, you know, in your narration, not just about the fact, but about things it makes you think about.
Yes, and our imagination and our entire approach as human beings. How do we enter a cave like this? How do we experience it? How does it surpass our wildest dreams? All this, I think, you would not see in a National Geographic documentary.
As wonderful as those National Geographic documentaries are.
Mine are better. Sorry for saying that. I say it only in quotes.
Okay.
My apologies, National Geographic. Accept my apologies. But I think my films are different. And I think the way I shot and present Cave of Forgotten Dreams is different. And it's a position which moves away from what you normally expect from a documentary.
I'll just say I'm glad that your films and National Geographic films exist.
All right, let's accept it like that. There's cohabitation.
Cohabitation, exactly.
Yes.
So when I was watching your cave documentary and there were references to cave bears that existed then and are now long extinct, I couldn't help but think of the documentary that you made, Grizzly Man, which is such a terrific film. And it's a documentary about Timothy Treadwell, this guy who went to the wild to film grizzly bears and saw himself as like the friend of the grizzlies, but it was not an environment that a human belonged in. And eventually he was eaten. He and his girlfriend were eaten by a bear. And he actually got that on audio tape, and the audio tape survived their deaths. So thinking about when you were in the cave and thinking about all the cave bears that used to be in there, did you think about Grizzly Man?
I always think in a way about Grizzly Man. Whenever I step out into nature or wild nature, I immediately have Timothy Treadwell present. And of course, he marks a position which, of course, was a tragic misunderstanding of wild nature. He romanticized it, and he saw it as if the bears were all like in Walt Disney movies, friendly, fluffy creatures. Of course, they are ferocious, and they ultimately eat you, and they kill you. Treadwell is always present in my life. I can't just discard this incredible man, this wonderful man in a movie. He's always around somehow.
You seem to really be attracted to, I know I'm stating the obvious here, to extreme personalities and extreme environments. In terms of personalities, you have Timothy Treadwell from Grizzly Man, the character of Aguirre in Aguirre, the Wrath of God. Then, of course, you're attracted to extreme environments. You did a documentary about this recently discovered cave that's 30,000 years old. You did a documentary about discoveries in Antarctica. Do you consider yourself to be an extreme personality?
Difficult question. No, I don't think so. I'm a professional. I'm a filmmaker. What you are trying to combine makes a lot of sense. Many people tell me, you have been everywhere. You have shot in the Amazon, in the Sahara Desert, in Antarctica even. That would be horizontally spreading out, but I've always tried to look deep into the human condition. This is why I do a film on Timothy Treadwell. This is why I film Aguirre, The Wrath of God, and other films. So it's always a look deep into the abyss, into the deepest recesses of the human soul, or as far as you can scrutinize with a camera. And it's maybe significant at the moment I'm doing a film on death row inmates, and I thought about a title, and I came up with Gazing into the Abyss. And then the name of a person on death row, like Joseph Garcia on death row, Michael Perry on death row, Linda Carty on death row, but all under the umbrella title, Gazing into the Abyss. And all of a sudden it dawned on me, well, that would have been a great title for the cave film. It would have been a great title for Timothy Treadwell. It would have been a great title for Aguirre, the Wrath of God, as if I was more somebody who was vertically looking as deep as it gets.
Werner Herzog speaking to Terry Gross in 2011. A new 16-disc Blu-ray collection of his films has recently been released by Shout Factory.